Wisconsin State Assembly has adjourned its regular session for the year following a marathon overnight session that didn't conclude until 4:45 this morning. During the more than 14 hours in session that began Thursday afternoon, the Assembly passed a bill designed to make oral chemotherapy drugs more affordable, but it amended it. It passed a bill to limit early voting hours and would impose new requirements for people exposed to asbestos who bring lawsuits for damages. The chemotherapy bill must now be passed by the Senate or it will die. We will cover these issues and many more in this edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have with us two guests from different political perspectives to discuss and debate the issues in the news this week. And we welcome your input, your questions, the story that mattered most to you. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guests, and we are happy to have them with us. Kevin Benversi is a freelance writer and blogger. He used to work at the Heritage Foundation. He served in President George W. Bush's administration and worked on several state Republican campaigns. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And also with us is Peg Lautenschlager, former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, a former state legislator and former United States attorney. Also now an attorney with the law firm Bauer & Bach. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Peg.
Thanks to both of you for being with us. Well, all right, marathon session ended in the wee hours of the morning. Let's start with the voting, the limits on early voting. In-person absentee voting would no longer be allowed past 7 o'clock at night or on weekends in Wisconsin under this bill that has now passed both houses of the legislature and is on its way to the governor's desk. Peg Lautenschlager, your reaction to these limitations on in-person absentee voting?
Well, I was sorry to see that was happening. Obviously, we have a number of people who work during the week, particularly on Monday through Fridays, although if the Assembly has its way, maybe they'll be working on weekends too. But having the ability for people who do have jobs where they are required to be there for substantial hours from Monday through Friday limits their ability to get to the polls at convenient times. The Assembly folks who were in favor of this, and Republicans who were in favor of this in both houses, spoke a lot about two things. Number one, they spoke about uniformity in voting hours throughout the state, and secondly, they talked about voter fraud and abuse. I don't think the notion of when polls are open in any way impacts voter fraud or abuse. If there's an argument that can be made on that, I'd be interested in seeing it or hearing it. In terms of uniformity of hours, we have never had uniformity of hours, and this bill doesn't really do much in order to create uniformity of hours. What it does is it limits the number of hours that can be open. For example, in my hometown of Fond du Lac, you're able to go to City Hall during the times, or whatever, the City County Government Center, and during the times they are open, you can vote. They don't have extended hours during weekends or evenings. Likewise, in several of the townships near Fond du Lac, in order to vote early absentee, you need to call up the town hall and the town clerk and make arrangements to meet her or him at the town hall. There are no open early voting hours that exist in some of those places. This bill does nothing in order to create uniformity in terms of those voting places where there aren't extended hours. It simply says you can't have a lot of them, lot of hours so that it'll be more uniform. So I think both arguments kind of fall down the drain, I guess.
Kevin, what's the deal with that?
Well, I for one am not really a fan of early voting. I admit I've voted absentee in the past, and I'm fairly certain Scott Ross of One Wisconsin Now is now looking that up on the internet.
Maybe he'll text me, Kevin.
If he did, tell him I say hi. the reality is we have Election Day for a purpose, and Peg says people can't get off to vote on Election Day. They're legally bound, your employer is legally bound to allow you to go vote and not have it, you know, act against any of your responsibilities to work. I mean, I understand, you know, the argument will say, well, you know, this is not against uniformity. You know, why, frankly, should Dane County and Milwaukee County be the only ones who think they're justified to open up on weekends? What if suddenly this was going on in Waukesha County? Where would Democrats not be crying foul if that was going on because there's a bunch of Republican voters in Waukesha County or in Ozaukee County or Washington County or, you know, any of the other, you know, ring counties that surround Milwaukee and Dane counties? So, I mean, I see this as, frankly, you know, one of these things where it's a lot of hubbub being made over what's probably not going to affect anything in the long run. You can still vote absentee. You can still go and do early voting, you know, for 45 business hours, Monday through Friday for the 2 weeks before an election day. And all this is going to do is just pretty much stop weekend, you know, special session bus drives, which have been, you know, a cornerstone of the Democratic voter, get out the vote effort for almost decades.
Let me ask you, Kevin, to respond to the arguments that Democrats say Republicans are trying to suppress the vote in the bigger cities of Madison and Milwaukee, who have more voters, and they tend to vote Democratic.
Well, again, you can still go and vote on the weekdays. I mean, why does it always seem to be that this is about, you know, suppressing the vote, going on weekends? These are people who where offices have what would appear to be more manpower than your rural offices, or as in Peg's case, Fond du Lac. I don't think they have the staff or the manpower to operate on weekends. Probably a Dane or a Milwaukee County would. So this is one of these things where it's like it's a little unfair to the rest of the state that suddenly you're having these mass, you know, weekend voter drives, which, you know, may or may not, you know, you say there is no fraud. When you have buses of people that just show up to vote early and vote absentee, most clerks just throw their hands up when it comes to voter identification and actually verifying that people are where they're supposed to be. Oh. So who knows what's going on in those cases?
Oh, my, Kevin. I mean, you look at the way we have lines if we limit voting to Election Day, people waiting for 5, 6, 7 hours. The reality is having the early voting allows clerks some more time in order to check things out thoroughly and spread out the voting a little bit so that we don't have to worry about all of these folks coming to the poll within a 12-hour period
places.
Of time. And open it up in Waukesha, open it up in Washington County. I think the more opportunities people have to vote where they aren't expected to drop everything during their workday, ask for the employer's consent to get out of work and get to a polling place, what's wrong with that? And maybe what we should do if we're just going to vote on Election Day is do as most Western European countries do and have it be a holiday and don't allow anybody to work on Election Day.
Let me move on to another issue. The Assembly also passed an amended version of the oral chemotherapy bill. It includes a $100 a month copay cap for patients buying chemo in pill form. This bill was going to mandate insurance plans cover the oral form of chemotherapy just as they do the IV form of chemotherapy in a clinic setting. Democrat says that this amendment needlessly puts the bill at risk of not passing in the Senate. Kevin, now your thoughts on why this bill needed this amendment for the copay?
My base understanding is they were trying to conform to what the most recent bills that other states had passed, such as California and Missouri, which did include copays. I mean, California, I believe the copay is $200. Missouri, it's $700 with an attachment that it increases at a rate similar to inflation, the CPI, Consumer Price Index. So that was kind of the reason. This was one of these weird things where it felt like a story. This was a bill that it will maybe affect 5% of cancer patients at max, because most medical physicians will tell you they would prefer someone to get chemotherapy in a observed location through intravenously instead of at home getting oral. Some people obviously due to, you know, allergies and whatnot can't take the intravenous chemotherapy, so thus they have to do the oral thing. That, you know, this maybe been, you know, more of a kind of a media hype, a potential, I mean, last week of the session, trying to get an issue for election day, kind of feels that going on. I understand the concerns of the Senate, but if Democrats in the Senate are balking at $100 copay attachment to this, then you have to ask, why were they supporting this bill in the first place?
What do you think of this $100 copay amendment, Peg?
Well, first of all, I have some real issues with the copay amendment. This is something that's very personal to me. But as to the copay, we forget that what sounds like $100 to many, or it's a somewhat insignificant amount to many, many people. For cancer victims, particularly those who are having a hard time with chemotherapy and can't work during their time they are ill or being treated, $100 a month or whatever is a huge copay. You add that to all of the other copays somebody may be having to cover when it comes to other drugs. It's not like this pill is going to be the only drug most cancer patients are taking. I agree with Kevin that a lot of times doctors would like to have somebody get cancer treatment intravenously and view it at the hospital. They could also take the pills at the hospital, walk in, take the pill, go out, or they can take them at home. If you have cancer and you know this is a drug you're supposed to be taking that might be able to cure you or at least lengthen your lifetime, taking those pills is going to be very important. And I don't think it's the kind of thing where you need a doctor or a nurse or somebody looking over you to see if you're taking the medication. As to the so-called media hype about this, having the option of taking a pill versus having intravenous drugs, it's a no-brainer, and it isn't media hype. It has to do with people's time. It has to do with their ability to have chemotherapy. These drugs tend to mess up your veins, so just getting an IV into your arm is troublesome. To think that we had to have all of this deliberation over something as simple as this simply because the insurance companies didn't want to have the bill passed, I think is tragic and speaks poorly for our legislature.
Yeah. Speak about, Kevin, the majority of the Republicans in the Senate did support this clean bill, but it almost didn't come up for a vote until the media hype.
Well, I mean, that's a question of what was going on behind the scenes. I mean, the end of the day, with Senate passage, it's going to come down to what is Alberta Darling, who is the chief sponsor and I'm assuming author of the bill, going to do. From what I've heard rumbling or read in the media, it sounds like it's going to pass. In the end of the day, I'm glad to see it pass, but the other side of the equation, and this is just, you know, my libertarian leanings going, it feels like a mandate from the government being forced upon a business, which is, you know, going to cost all of us in insurance, you know, coverage. So who knows? But, I mean, you know, we're living in a world where, you know, through the ACA, that government is mandating everything in healthcare. So it's, you know, kind of, you know, you're throwing your hands up there, too.
What do you think is going to happen with this, Peg? The Senate still has to consider it.
I think it's going to be hard for them not to pass it through as is. Like I say, I was disappointed to see the $100 copay, but I think under the something is better than nothing rule. If they don't pass it, I have a hard time believing that the reason it's not being passed or not being signed into law is going to be because of the pressure from the insurance companies. That's what this is about. This isn't about, there are a few folks who are truly libertarians who don't want to see government mandates, but as Kevin says, you know, right now there are so many mandates when it comes to the area of health care. This is about insurance companies and their concerns about this. So I think we're going to see something go through, but if we don't, I think people who could have benefited from this legislation ought to squarely place it in the laps of insurance companies and those legislators who are supporting them.
Final thoughts on this bill, Kevin?
No, I mean, it's like I said, I think it's going to pass, and then we'll know for sure on April 1st.
We are talking with Kevin Benversi and Peg Lautenschlager, our two guests for this edition of The Week in Review, covering a lot of state politics, first off, as the Assembly finished up its legislative session very early this morning by passing a number of bills. So we're clicking through those, and we'll talk about other top national stories as well. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking to our two Week in Review guests about the top state, national, and international stories of the week. And we welcome the issue you want to talk about, your input on the issues that we are talking about at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Okay, another bill that was passed in the Wisconsin Assembly in this in the last day of the session, a bill that opponents say would deny justice to people exposed to asbestos. Veterans are among the most vocal opponents of the measure, passed on a party line vote of 55-38. The bill now heads to Governor Walker. It would require plaintiffs who have suffered from asbestos exposure to reveal how many businesses their attorneys plan to sue. Well, Peg, you're an attorney. Will this make it more difficult for people harmed by asbestos to collect damages?
Absolutely will. It's going to be one more hurdle which people trying to seek a redress of grievances in our court system are going to have to overcome before they can get into the courtroom itself. You know, this is part of what has been a very long assault on people's rights to get into courts. We are seeing that the number of jury trials nationally as well as locally is going down because it's become more and more difficult. What I would perceive as a myth of people always getting to go into court in order to rectify any wrong is certainly not a reality in this day and age. And this is one more way in which you take victims of asbestos exposure suffering from a horrific kind of cancer called mesothelioma and limiting their ability to get something for their horribly shortened lives and also for the horrible death which they all face.
Kevin?
Well, I look, this is more or less kind of a way to control out-of-control tort costs. I mean, they talk about, this second veterans, and I know obviously there are some who served in subs and God knows what else that did have asbestos at the time, and they do have rightful claims. But there are many who, you know, are just using veterans as a front to see what is pretty much just a tort reform bill, and it's really kind of shameful that they're using military service and those who served, you know, is nothing but front groups.
Let's move to another bill. We're clicking through all these bills. The Assembly passed a limited school accountability bill. Republicans dropped their plan to impose sanctions on failing schools. Rather, the bill that passed has no sanctions and mirrors what passed in the Senate. So now lawmakers will meet this summer with education officials to draft a comprehensive school accountability board by January. The hope is to come up with a better school report card, sanctions for low-performing schools, incentives for high-performing schools, among other things. So, Kevin, starting with you, reaction to this.
Well, I think this, for those who wanted a school accountability bill, and I would say I was probably in that group, it's a bit of a letdown. I mean, the reality was that there was a block of senators who just weren't going to go for any kind of real hard credentialed bill. So it had to be steamed back. So I mean, I think, you know, standards, you know, be them what they may. I mean, this was one of those weird things where you had the left and the right. I read somewhere online, I don't know what it was, Part of the reason why everyone seems to hate Common Core, and I'm not one of these people who defends Common Core, I'm just using this as an analogy here, is that the left hates Common Core because of the standards in national standards. The right hates Common Core because of the national in national standards. So one of these weird things where Wisconsin is just trying to establish a system of standards and get schools to have some sense of accountability if they are underperforming, and it's a missed opportunity.
Peg?
I think that the bill itself reflects what I frankly think is a kind of a nationwide issue that permeates all sorts of things in our lives, which is everybody is trying to take measurements and determine success or failure based on these measurements, that somehow we can take things and put them all on a grid and say you are passing, you are not, whatever. When it comes to comparing schools, when it comes to the kinds of services, the kinds of education schools deliver, oftentimes we find ourselves comparing apples and oranges. We find kids who are in perhaps more elite schools where they have the ability to accept or reject students being in the school, where they have the ability to take the children out of the school or put them in a more generally populated school. We have differences in terms of staff support that's given these schools. We have differences in terms of how parents come into the school system, whether or not they are supportive of their children's educations or whether or not they aren't for whatever reason. And then we tried to take all of these, figure out some couple of numbers and say, oh, these are good schools, these are bad schools. I think the reality is we all need to recognize that in certain things in life, and I believe education is one of them, we have a public duty to educate. That education can come in a variety of ways, can be measured in a variety of ways, and that we need to afford our schools, particularly our public schools, sufficient resources in order to do that job. What I see with these bills are kind of these quick fix solutions so everybody can feel better about things, but it really doesn't get to whether or not Johnny can read or write or think analytically.
Well, let me ask you, we're going to move on to some other issues, including the new job creation numbers, but before we kind of tie a bow on this legislative session, at least the Assembly wrapped up its session, I'm just going to ask you both, just what was the biggest success or failure of this legislative session or glaring omission? Peg, what do you think was the best thing or the worst thing the legislature did?
Well, presuming we're going to get to jobs next, I think probably the biggest failure is the way in which the legislature is going to yet again chip away at the rights of voters and the opportunities for regular people to get to the polling places and vote. The notion somehow our primary concern when it comes to voting is not ensuring the right to vote, but rather ensuring that there is no fraud committed, even though this is a boogeyman that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, your assessment, the best thing, the worst thing?
For me, I thought it was the tax package. I think the tax reform package, I think it's needed. I mean, Wisconsin has far too many, for a state, tax brackets, which are just insane to begin with. It's a good start. I think, more needs to be done in the long term, but I think, more money in our pockets is always good in my mind.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Kevin Benversi and Peg Lautenschlager during this edition of our Week in Review. If you have an issue in the news that you would like to suggest we discuss, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. All right, well, let's talk about job numbers. New job numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics show that for the 12-month period between September of 2012 and September of 2013, Wisconsin added more than 28,000 private sector jobs. That ranks Wisconsin 35th in the nation in terms of job creation. That's up from 37th 3 months ago. What do you think, Peg, is Wisconsin on the right or the wrong track when it comes to job creation?
Well, I think it's on the wrong track. Unfortunately, I think that the kinds of tax incentives which the governor has given to large corporations have not only not produced jobs, but I think as well they have produced a working underclass of people making minimum wage, maybe $10 an hour, no benefits or whatever. And so we not only have very little job creation, but we have this growing underclass of people who are dependent upon government programs which fill in the gaps where their employers aren't making payments. I think we need to start focusing on things that matter in this state. We need to make certain that we have a well-trained workforce. I would say that the $35 million that's going to technical college education and the like is at least a small hopeful sign. But we need to be looking at that. We need to be looking at our schools and putting money into them. We need to be looking at ensuring that our communities have the resources in order to keep up things like infrastructure and public places so that businesses that might be interested in locating here are interested in locating here on a permanent long-term basis where they can become part of healthy, flourishing communities.
Kevin, your reaction to the ranking?
Well, I think, you know, compared to other states, I mean, Illinois right below us is number 50. So, I mean, we're not there. I mean, it's not great. It's not a great number. It's not a horrific number. As like I said, Illinois is number 50. You know, it's, you can want to bring that up. That came out in the same numbers. I mean, I've said in the past, and I think I've said it here in previous week in reviews, I've never been a big fan of the $250,000 job pledge because I thought it was just economically infeasible when it was proposed. I'm always amazed to listen to Democrats and liberals act as if Wisconsin lives in a static economic bubble, that only what happens here matters, when the fact is, you know, we're what, pumping out, if we're lucky, on a month nationally, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 180,000 to 200,000 jobs a month. This is a very stagnant economy. Guess what? It's affecting America. It's going to continue to affect the state of Wisconsin until, you know, that suddenly keeps going back again. I mean, you know, yeah, it's you know, we're doing the best we can. I think I agree with Peg in the sense that $35 million to tech colleges is a great start, and hopefully it's an investment for the future. Peg brings up infrastructure projects. I'm all for that. I just hope that, you know, her friends in the environmental movement don't, you know, picket and try to stop road projects in the future. So that's my take on it.
Wait, before we get to Peg's friends, let me ask you.
Wow. And you're worried that Scott Ross knows how many times you voted absentee?
No, not really. I think it's like maybe five.
Kevin, you mentioned Illinois being number 50. There are charts that show of all Midwestern states, though Illinois, yes, is below Wisconsin. But Wisconsin, out of the 10 Midwestern states, is the ninth worst. Why aren't we keeping pace with the rest of the Midwest,
except Illinois? Well, I think it's probably a number of factors. I mean, we had pretty much we are a high tax state, so is Illinois. We have, in terms of corporate headquarters, not as many as other states. I mean, Iowa is a farming equipment mecca. Minnesota has Target, 3M, and numerous corporations that seem to, you know, the state welcomes as corporate friends. Same with Indiana and Michigan. I mean, you know, I haven't even brought up the various states that are potentially right to work or could go right to work in the next decade. I mean, all those are things that Wisconsin does not have then, you know, and I know liberals don't like this argument. We also had what in essence was a year and a half economic shell game going on where, you know, you had everyone upset about Act 10 and using boycotts, pretty much giving an immense amount of uncertainty in the economy of who's going to be my state senator, who's going to be my governor. So, you know, that's going to affect the business environment because there's nothing a businessman hates more than the idea of things suddenly changing on a whim.
Well, I think, though, too, Kevin, you have to acknowledge, and I know I'm sure you view the New York Times as a liberal puff piece, but about a year ago it had a fascinating study in it where they talked about corporate headquarters and how corporate headquarters, one of the primary concerns about moving a headquarters to a particular place is, what is that local community like? Does it have parks? Does it have good police and fire? Does it have good public and private schools? Does it have opportunities for the arts and things like that? And what we are seeing under this administration is a continued strangling of those local services based on tax policy that's supposedly going to give these big employers tax breaks and give people who are wealthy tax breaks. At some point, we have to realize that investing in our communities, whether it be its roads, whether it be its water supply, whether it be having an art center or whatever, are the kinds of things that draw people in corporations to want to live there. And we're going to have to get our acts together, and rather than going to least common denominator, we have lower taxes than Mississippi kind of philosophy. And I hope that that will change with this upcoming election.
Well, reacting to the 35th in the nation job creation ranking, Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca was critical, saying that Republicans are ignoring jobs to focus on an extreme agenda. Kevin, should Republicans have concentrated more on jobs during the legislative session?
Well, I mean, I'm not the one. I think what they're, you know, what they're, I'm not going to be the one to second guess what Robin Buss and, you know, Scott Fitzgerald did is in their leadership. I think they heralded through what was probably, you know, it's one of these weird times come, you know, a legislative session right before a governor's term. So they're playing the political safe game. I mean, you know, I think, you know, tax, I'm like I said, I'm more of a, you know, fan of lowering taxes on businesses so that, you know, they can go that route instead of, you know, the way that PEG seems to go about, you know, let's just invest in everything. Well, you know, then you have scenarios where, you know, government is local governments are the ones that are wasting, you know, potentially millions of dollars that could have been going to who knows what. I mean, so that's you know, it's a mixed bag.
PEG?
Well, I think that the notion of playing a politically safe game is a little troubling, because essentially what has happened is this legislature has become libertarian when it comes to government mandates on business or those who have considerable resources, but on the other hand have become anything but libertarians when it comes to abrogating rights on social issues for the vast majority of Wisconsin citizens. And so to pretend that there is some sort of philosophical integrity in all of this, I think is bad. Nobody paid attention to jobs, because there were all of these kind of wedge issues which could fulfill the demands of certain special interest groups, and on those wedge issues, the Assembly went nuts, whether it be abortion, whether it be voter ID, whether it be charter schools or homeschooling or whatever. Those were the kinds of issues which got attention, and the issues of the regular working person in Wisconsin who's just trying to find a job and make a living wage by working 40, 60 hours a week, those kind of issues were non-existent when it came to this legislative agenda.
Well, we will talk about other top stories in state and national politics as our week in review continues. We will, by the way, be talking with State Representative Peter Barca on our state capitol report on Monday at 7:30, from 7:30 until 8. So more state news coverage in our state capitol report Monday mornings, every Monday morning between 7 and 8. But stay with us here on the Week in Review. Coming up next, it's our Week in Review quiz. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. It's time now for our Week in Review quiz. Well, if you happen to come across Governor Walker on Sesame Street, your eyes are not deceiving you. He is appearing in two 40-second PSAs to promote what? With a couple of Sesame Street Muppets. So what is Governor Walker appearing in these Sesame Street PSAs to promote what? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. If you have a guess, we'll give you 5 minutes to to guess, and we will randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers, announce the answer and the winner at the end of the show. The winner will get something wonderful like a Wisconsin Public Radio pen or bottle opener. So give that a shot. What is Governor Walker helping to promote in two new Sesame Street PSAs? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's get back to our week in review. We are, by the way, talking with freelance writer and blogger Kevin Benversi and former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, attorney now with the law firm Bauer and Bach, Peg Lautenschlager, about all the top, mainly state news stories of the week. And speaking of Governor Walker, the Freedom of Religion Foundation, Freedom From Religion Foundation, is not too happy with a recent tweet that the governor sent out, and it's calling for its removal. Walker tweeted a Bible verse that reads, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." The foundation says it's disturbing that a public official would compose such a tweet. Well, what do you think, Peg? Should that tweet come down?
Well, I think there are a number of ways to look at it. First is the Bible verse itself and the sort of almost arrogance that might be considered to be attached to the tweet that I am powerful because I believe in Christ or whatever. That aside, I think had he tweeted a verse from the Quran, the same people who are supporting him would have gone nuts, probably would have recalled him by now. And thirdly, I guess my thought is that you almost wonder if this wasn't put up in order to go to one of those wedge issues, the church-state issue, and get fundamentalists riled up. Governor Walker has tweets that come out on political things as well as in a variety of political, non-governmental things. He could have put it there, but instead opted to use his apparently work tweet account in order to do this. And I think, that obviously says this isn't something about a Christian value and belief of his, but rather an attempt to get some political mileage out of it with the people on the evangelical right.
Mm-hmm. Kevin.
Wow. That was a fascinating take. I'll go with the likely true answer here, which is that or option four over Peg's list, which is Scott Walker is a preacher's son and he's deeply religious. And if you actually look at the Bible verse and interpret it one way, it is, "I am humble and only through the strength and will of God do I get through my day."
You didn't have to put humble in there, man.
Not anything else like that, and that's all I'm saying. and since apparently this is now a string of things that the Gaylors and the Freedom from Religion Foundation are doing, I give them their next target in a press release yesterday from Senate Representative Andy Jurgensen. State Representative Andy Jurgensen, Democrat Milton, today welcomed Father David Tillman to the Assembly Chambers to lead the body in prayer on the final day of legislative session. The floor is yours.
All right, are we done with that one?
Yeah. I would like an answer to the Quran part, though.
Well, so, again, Kevin, you don't think there's anything wrong with the governor of the state of Wisconsin tweeting a Bible verse?
No, mm-hmm. I don't. I think it's a really ridiculous non-story that only militant atheists care about.
All right. And Peg, is the Freedom From Religion Foundation making too big a deal about this?
No, in our democracy, you have people who fit on all parts of the political spectrum. I don't know if it's linear or three-dimensional or whatever, but the reality is that having a group that is vigilant when it comes to church and state separation is not a bad thing. And while Kevin or somebody may disagree with it, like I say, I think number one, this is something where having a force like that out there plays an important role in the overall political picture. But secondly, I think I have a hard time believing that in part this wasn't done in order to evoke the same kind of response which we are predictably getting from people like Kevin today, which is like, This guy is very religious. This keeps the religious right, knowing that Scott Walker isn't just a business cut taxes kind of governor, but that he fulfills that kind of Mike Huckabee role in the mix of Republican political types. And I think it was probably carefully calculated and something which went out there for the very reasons that we are discussing now.
Yeah. Very briefly, just getting a reaction from both of you on the death of the founder of the Westboro Baptist Church, Fred Phelps. He died this week, and there's a lot of reaction to that on social media. Some celebrating his death because he led church members to protest at the soldiers or funerals of soldiers, saying that this was God was killing our soldiers because this country is too promiscuous or believes in gay rights. I'm wondering, is this something to celebrate, Peg?
Oh, I don't think it's something to celebrate. I mean, I think death is not a pleasant thing, particularly in this society. Nobody looks forward to it. Nobody celebrates it. There are a number of people who are viewed as vile figures by some who have met their deaths, and I think whether it's the Ayatollah or Bin Laden or whatever, to say that we celebrate death would be inappropriate. To say perhaps that we have a lack of concern, or that perhaps this is a just ending or whatever is another thing. I think it's inappropriate to celebrate death regardless of who it is, on whatever side of the political spectrum, or however heinous or not heinous. But on the other hand, I always figure folks have to come to grips with death in some way, shape, or form, and who knows what will happen to the Westboro Church people.
Yeah, do you blame some people for celebrating his passing, Kevin?
Well, I mean, now is probably an opportune time to give one of my favorite Twain quotes, which is, "I do not wish a man dead, but there have been certain obituaries which have made me smile." So it's death is never, something you want to root for somebody. I mean, you do have condolences to his family. What the man did for professionally was heinous and wrong, and should not have been applauded by anyone. I mean, this is, be it military families or be it gay families or whoever. I mean, this guy, was not a great dude. And I mean, do I want to say good riddance? There's part of me that does, but also, it's one of these things where you're like, just be glad he's gone and he can't harm anyone or disrupt anyone else's funeral or their family's grieving process from now on.
Let's move on to a couple of national issues. Some national news. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson is back from a fact-finding mission to Ukraine. He says Russian President Vladimir Putin is bent on expansion to restore the Soviet Union and that the U.S. has to do more than impose economic sanctions. He wants the U.S. to send military aid to Ukraine, but not American troops. He talked about this on Wisconsin Public Radio's Central Time yesterday afternoon. Is Senator Johnson right, Kevin?
Well, I think that we definitely need to be more proactive. I mean, they're especially with some of the sanctions and just the way the Obama administration is rolling them out, there's a very haphazard, very stuttered approach. I mean, first we go after 7 guys, and we go after another 9 guys, and it's very weird. I do agree with the sense, especially since the words and the mannerisms of Vladimir Putin, that there is a kind of drive to either not reassemble the Soviet Union, but kind of recreate Russia under the era of Peter the Great. Maybe let's go farther back into our Russian history here. I mean, he's talking now about, Estonia. Well, Estonia is a NATO nation, so that's going to up the ante even more if suddenly stuff starts going on. And is Crimea, just the first part, or future steps in the beginning? As for, a military aid, the real question is, what could we give without, further, escalating? Do we provide new tanks? Do we provide better air support? Do we help enact a no-fly zone? I mean, those are options on the table.
Mm-hmm. Peg, your thoughts on this?
Obviously, this is a very difficult situation, and it's one where things could get out of control, and if they do, it could be horrific. I actually support the president's incremental approach to sanctions, where he keeps ratcheting up the pressure. I think that military aid is sort of the last step before you send in troops, so jumping to that right away doesn't really leave us with an end game or any kind of how do we get off of the dime kind of options. And, I agree that with Kevin that this is some sort of Russification thing that shows the likes of Peter the Great, Tsar Nicholas I, whoever it happens to be. I also get nervous about these NATO nations because obviously we have a duty based on treaty in order to defend. But I also think that, we have to be careful. While the domino theory sort of thing is kind of reared its ugly head again, and now Crimea, what next? And it may have legitimacy, but it might not either, and we don't want to find ourselves, jumping off the cliff and going in whole hog into something where we can't back off unless we know for sure what's going to happen.
All right. Well, the National Review made a comment this week on the situation in Ukraine, and it's saying that while Vladimir Putin is redrawing Russian borders, President Obama is unveiling his bracket picks. Is that a little harsh, Kevin?
Well, I think it's more of a statement of what appears to be the priorities of each leader. It's an overglossing of sorts, but I mean, look at the activities of this week. You have a very strong Russian force which annexes Crimea in a very public fashion. I mean, I believe it was finalized this morning. And what is the biggest media moment for the president this week? Talking with Andy Katz of ESPN on a four whiteboard, filling out an NCAA bracket. It's a strange dichotomy. In a media, public relations, public perception standpoint, it applies.
A reaction, Peg, briefly, because we're almost out of time.
Okay, I think it's anything but that. And in terms of priorities of each leader, we don't see Barack Obama running around without his shirt. What we have seen a lot this week is his running around talking about jobs, talking about unemployment, talking about things like that. And as for his bracket pick, I think it's fair to say that's driven by the audience, which is all those folks who can't vote on weekends. So they might as well pay attention to basketball.
Well, let's say congratulations to Dave and Wanaki. He's the winner of this week's Week in Review quiz. We asked, what is Governor Walker helping to promote in two new Sesame Street PSAs? And the answer is healthy living. Let's take a listen.
Hey, it's Abby and Rosita from Sesame Street.
Hiya, Governor Walker.
Yep, we're just having a snack.
Yep.
Well, good choice. You know, they say you are what you eat.
So, we're bananas?
No, that just means when you eat healthy food, you feel healthy too.
All right, so that was Governor Walker, by the way, was wearing a big red Badgers sweatshirt in the ad. It's part of Sesame Street's Healthy Habits for Life campaign, and it was filmed last month at the National Governors Association conference. Other politicians in the past who have done these include former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. Very, very briefly, Peg, Kevin, do you think Governor Walker has some good acting skills there? I guess no one's going to answer that.
Well, I'm glad we're not killing Big Bird anymore. I'm glad everybody's on Michelle Obama's healthy eating thing,
yeah.
And basketball bracket Sesame Street. I don't know, Joy.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We're out of time. Everybody have a great weekend. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Week in Review here on the Ideas Network.